Restaurants employ over 15 million people nationwide, and two-thirds of all restaurants are independently owned and not part of big chains. Yet currently, these small businesses are not represented in government relief negotiations. Roar is working to change that by fighting for relief opportunities for all restaurants. Roar is advocating for an 8-point plan in New York State that will allow restaurants to reopen and rehire when the time comes. Dozens of industry leaders have signed on to the plan, like Nam Wa Tea Parlor, Field Trip, Momofuku, and many more of your favorites. You can join them at change.org by searching for ROAR, Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief, with your hosts, Zara Tangora and Bobby Comforto. I am doing the intro and outro alone today, as Bobby and I are keeping our very safe distance from one another. And we have a really great episode for you today that was recorded several weeks ago. So you'll notice that there's no mention of coronavirus or the after effects of it or the current effects of it. And that is because it was recorded a few weeks ago. How are you guys doing out there? Are you okay? Are you healthy? Are you safe? Are you feeling sane? Are you triggered? What's going on? We want to hear about it. You can stay in touch with us for write-ins of listener letters about what you're experiencing at this time, and we'd be happy to read them on a special episode that we're putting together about listener letters, about what people are going through during this really wild experience in the time of Corona. And if you just want to write us a letter to reach out because you need support and you're scared or you're upset and you do not want it shared publicly, that's also totally fine. All emails can be submitted to processing@heritageradionetwork.org. We love you and we want to be here for you as best we can, even though we can't be physically here to give you a hug. We want to give you an emotional hug. So today on the show, we have an amazing human, author, Lisa Kolb Roland. Lisa is a really wonderful person. We had a great chat. Her and I met up for a coffee. We dually interviewed each other. She interviewed me for her newly launched food blog called The Unpeeled Journal, which has seasonal recipes, essays, food guides, and women in food profiles. But she's also has a big section which heavily relies on food and grief. So that's how we connected. And it's very symbiotic in that way. And she's really a wonderful, lovely person. Lisa has written for publications like Food 52, The Washington Post, Eater, Modern Loss, Remedy Quarterly, and the Napa Valley Register. She's also appeared on the BBC's Food Chain, which is a really great podcast. And we really loved Lisa. She's a very tender and sweet person. Her story is pretty incredible and very sad, but also very hopeful. And she is a very hopeful and very lovely and very strong person. So it was our pleasure to speak with Lisa, and we hope that you enjoy our chat. Thank you. So we're talking to Lisa Kolb Roland today. How's it going, Lisa?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we kind of connected. We were connected by a mutual friend, and we just kind of really hit it off and met yesterday for a coffee, and I was just instantly drawn to you and so excited that you were going to come join us on the show. And your story is really amazing. Your writing is amazing, and we both want to start off by thanking you so much for taking your time and being vulnerable and coming to talk to us.
Thank you as well.
Yeah. So you are a food writer.
Yes.
And you've written for the Washington Post, Eater, Modern Loss, Remedy Quarterly. Anything I'm leaving out that?
Food 52.
Food 52.
And Eater.
And Eater, yes. So what is it about food? How did this all start for you?
It's so funny. I just think it's one of those things I always just kind of took for granted. And I actually made my way all the way through being a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I did that for about a year and a half and realized it was just kind of something that I think I just put myself on a path toward without really thinking about if it's really something that I wanted to be. Right. And so I quit being a lawyer and decided to do something that was completely the opposite of that, which is I took myself to California and I enrolled in the Culinary Institute of America, went to pastry school, got a pastry degree in the CIA, and then moved back to New York and pastry chefed for a couple years, and then just kind of evolved into food writing from there. I think, as you know from being a chef yourself, it's an extremely physically demanding, manual labor type of job.
It's so intense. Bobby knows too. I mean, Bobby used to own a catering business, the Love and Oven, and you know, so years. we're all aware of the extreme horrid physicalities.
I'm sure we all have burn marks up and down our arms.
Yeah, line burn marks. How did it start though? Was it something in your family that did your family like to cook? Did you always cook growing up and bake? Like, where did the interest kind of start?
My mom was always a great cook growing up, so she really instilled a lot of that in me and was a great home baker. And I just kind of found myself, even when I moved to New York, like, which I think is such like a restaurant and takeout culture. If I was at home, it never occurred to me to get takeout. It was always like, oh, well, I'm home, so I'm cooking. So I did that, just really commonly. And I just kind of feel like all human beings, I think, especially in like a very desky, computery world we live in, kind of at some level have a need for a creative outlet. And I think cooking and baking is that, and it's just like a nurturing creative outlet. And I just kind of found that to be my passion.
Is it also the place where you go when you need to kind of, like, as we like to say on the show, kind of take your brain offline?
I my husband can tell you I like stress bake all the time. It's just like what I do. Like, I really need to make some cookies right now.
What's your go-to stress baking thing?
Usually my mom's apple cake recipe, and it's actually, out of all the like professional pastry chef-y things I can make, it's her apple cake recipe from her home ec class in the 70s.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It is delicious, and it's just one of these family favorite recipes.
Yeah.
And it's just great to whip up, and you can have it for breakfast. You can have it for dessert.
Ooh. And the smell when it's baking, right?
An apple cake.
There's nothing like an apple dessert when it's in the oven. Oh my God.
So yesterday we were kind of talking about, you know, we met and discussed our commonality in our experiences in grief, although the experiences are extremely different. I think we just bonded through just being able to talk about, you know, mostly I was talking about myself because you were asking the questions. But now today I'm going to ask you.
The tables have turned.
The tables have turned. But you experienced an extremely significant and unforeseen loss in your life. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think it's also extremely tied to food, and your writing since is right in line with kind of a lot of the questions that we're asking on this show about food and grief and where they intertwine. So can you tell us a little bit about how this journey began for you, what your experience is?
Yes. So in May of 2014, my late husband, Eric, was over Memorial Day weekend on a mountain climb on Mount Rainier with a group of mountain climbers, and they were doing a fairly dangerous route up Mount Rainier. And I hadn't expected to hear from him while he was on his climb, so there was nothing unusual about that. And then I actually had been helping out a friend who was a wedding cake designer in the morning, and I got out of my shift or whatever, helping her make sugar flowers, and was walking home, and I had a message with a Seattle area code on it. And I thought, oh, it's Eric. He's back from his climb, and his phone is dead, and whatever. So I listened to the voicemail, and it was the National Park Service saying that he and his group had not returned from their climb, and that they had set out a search party and helicopter. So I called back, and the National Park Service person, by the time I called back, they had found what is called a debris field, so they could see wreckage of, you know, tents and things. At that point, it was still a rescue mission. And then I was just kind of told, you probably want to fly out here to Seattle. And by the time I got to the airport, it was no longer a rescue mission. It was a recovery mission. And he and five other climbers had all died.
Oh, goodness. So. Oh,
you know, that feeling of you're just, you didn't expect your day to turn out like that. It's just so, it's such a, it's just wild.
It's just like one of those things. It was almost like, you know, like that 9/11 day with that bluebird sky. Yeah. And you remember exactly how the juxtaposition of the nice day just hit so much hard, like hit so hard, I think. It was the same thing. It was this beautiful day in May, and I'll just never forget how the breeze felt and how the sky looked. And it was like Joan Didion says, you know, life changes in the instant. Life changed in the instant.
In the year of magical thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a really powerful book.
And the concept of trauma, that it's more than we can handle. It's literally too much.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people ask the question of, when faced with extreme tragedy or hearing mostly stories of other people who've experienced things such like yourself, people always say, how could that be possible? How do you go on? You know, like, what do you, I could never do it. I wouldn't be able to. And, you know, I've said those things too offhand. I could never go on if X, Y, and Z happens. And I'm assuming maybe you have offhandedly before this as well. It's kind of something we throw around a lot. How did you go on in that day? How did you, like, what were the steps that happened?
I remember, it's so funny, because I almost felt like I was in this very bizarre autopilot in a way, where I was kind of just having this whole out-of-body experience. I remember forcing myself, I remember distinctly, I have all these kind of like bits and pieces of that day. Mm. I remember getting to Seattle. I don't remember the drive to Mount Rainier National Park, but I remember being in some motel room out there forcing myself to chew a grape.
Right.
Because I hadn't eaten since.
You were by yourself?
That morning. No, my father flew out with me. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I hadn't eaten all day, but I remember thinking I should probably eat something.
Yeah.
And I remember that feeling of like staring at a grape and forcing myself to chew it.
Yeah.
And it was just this very strange, this is a terrible analogy, but you know, like, if you're drunk sometimes, you have to kind of talk yourself into, okay, call the Uber.
Yes. Yeah, you're
check
on
oh, everything the license down. Plate. And you're just trying very hard to act like a human being.
Yes, absolutely. You're like, pretend that nothing's wrong. Yeah. No one will know that I'm drunk or great. You know, yeah, it slows down. Everything slows down.
It's emergency mode.
What is there a psychological kind of term for that, or
again,
reasoning?
It's post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And it is an out-of-body experience, because post-traumatic stress is a physical experience that changes your chemistry.
Right.
And, you know, in a way, parts of your functioning slow down, like your digestion slows down, your everything slows down, except for your extremities. So it's preparing for fight or flight. So certainly your brain functioning slows down, so you're really not thinking. You're thinking both quickly and very, very slow at the same time.
That's so true.
With a traumatic loss like that, I mean, you're thrust into an experience that you have no preparation for. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's interesting because we compare, I think, another thing we do as, you know, a would you rather type question or whatever, like, well, that would be the worst way to lose someone, or that would be the worst way to die, or I would never want to have cancer for 10 years, or I would never want to lose my partner in an accident. You know what I mean? And they all have these bizarre, terrible pros and cons. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the...
Well, sudden loss versus chronic.
Right. Like a chronic suffering. Loss, you get to say goodbye, but... And so you're prepared in a way. You're like, this will happen. It doesn't make the pain of the loss any more manageable or less manageable. But there's something about a sudden loss that it's like you don't even... Like it came out of nowhere,
it
I
is
would
more,
imagine,
it's
right?
more than we can handle. That's the concept.
Did it feel like that to you?
Yes. It was surreal.
Yeah.
And just kind of, I kind of couldn't believe it. Yeah. And even though my rational self believed he died, knew he died, I would say, I remember also thinking these random things to myself like, oh, but he can't be dead because we have our vacation to Peru booked next month.
Right.
He can't be dead because I already bought all the food I was going to make for his welcome home dinner.
Right.
The disbelief.
Yeah.
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 And it was just, oh my God, it was awful. And I, you know, I remember walking back into my apartment for the first time, coming back, and he wasn't going to be in it anymore. And that was the first time. And it was very, there were just so many small things. And that's the one thing that I learned a lot of things. But one of the things I learned was that the small things are everything. And it became all about his dirty laundry that was still in the hamper and just his little ways. And that's the stuff that really hit me the hardest.
Yeah. Well, the things that are kind of, I would imagine, like living on without him, like the dirty laundry that he'll, you know what I mean? And the food in the fridge that wasn't eaten. It's like these pieces that are oddly living on without the person.
It just stopped.
Yeah.
It was just so odd. And he, oh, I remember walking in, and I haven't talked about this much, but he had just gotten a year-long fellowship through his job to live in London, and we were going to move to London, and he had told me over the phone that he had gotten it, and we would celebrate when we got back together. And when I walked into the apartment, I realized he had left me, because I had been at the Jersey Shore for Memorial Day while he had flown out there. And when I walked in, he had left me a card just saying how excited he was that we were going abroad together. And when I got that, he was already dead. And so it was just very surreal. And they never recovered his body. He's still there. And so I never, I think there's something to that too, like not having the memorial service and that, like it was just like poof.
That's something that happened to 9/11. I don't know if Sarah told you, but I had worked with 9/11 families for about 4 years. And it made it very hard because there's the concrete thing, the rituals that we create in seeing the body, as hard as it is. And somebody just told me today, they go to the cemetery because they know that that's where the body is. And so whatever it is, there's something about not finding the body that makes it even more unreal. So how did you deal with that, the fact that he wasn't recovered? I mean, did you have a memorial service, or how did you?
Yeah, I mean, we had a memorial service for him, and it was at a country club, and, you know, there was no grave to go to. There was a very nice memorial service and a slideshow, and then it was just kind of over.
Yeah.
And, but then it's like, it kind of hit me all over again after the memorial service. And I think that that's something that happens. It's like it hits you at first when they first die, and then it hits a second time out, and then you're kind of swept into this whole period of memorial service, letting people know, kind of whirlwind.
Sure. Yes.
And then that all ends, and then you're just left to the rest of your life.
Right.
And then it hits in a second way.
Right.
And I would say just as hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of that has to do with the disbelief, particularly in sudden loss. And in a way, it's like a fog or a numbness that protects us. Thank goodness it's there, because if we had to take in the whole reality once, we would be decimated. We couldn't handle it.
That's very true, because I do think that I look back, I was like, how was I able to get on the phone with like these people and make arrangements?
Right.
You know, it's just, but I think you're right. We just kind of, this kind of instinct takes over, this functioning instinct. And then when that adrenaline or whatever it is, I don't even know, kind of drains. You're right. I think it allows that second wave to just kind of hit.
Right. I mean, it's a focus, right? It's something you can focus on. And also, you know, in the immediate, in the wake of this kind of thing happening, you don't tend to be at work, and you don't tend to have other things that you're focusing your energy on. So focusing on planning a funeral, a memorial service, or some things like that, there's like, okay, this task and this task and then this task, and then the tasks are done. And it, and while, I mean, for me, at least when my father passed away, I was the only one to kind of deal with his stuff. And I remember being so angry at the tasks, and even for, you know, 2 years after, being angry at the tasks, at the closing the estate and the papers and looking and getting things in the mail. And a friend of mine said at the time, because I was venting to him about it, and he hadn't been through a loss, so I was inclined to be annoyed at the statement, like from the get-go, but I actually ended up like really connecting with it. He was like, yes, but when the tasks are done, then they're going to be over, and in some way you're probably going to wish you had them back. And I was like, oh, my first instinct was to be like, fuck you. You don't know what this feels like. I do not want these tasks back. But when they were done, I mean, I can relate to what you're saying, in that like it sinks in a different way. And you're like, oh, I don't have this focus specifically anymore.
Yeah, it like suspends time in a way.
Yes, it does.
And then when that's over, it just kind of like, oh, wait, I still have to live my life now?
Yeah.
Like this.
It's also the things you hold on to. Like, you know, we want to hold on to some things. We have to let go of many things. Almost the live person, but there's so many things we want to hold on to. So you talked about the dirty laundry. Yeah. I don't know how long you kept that around. But, you know, some people really hold on to things, the toothbrush and the things that were part of their life. You know, and at some point we begin to let go of those. But what are some things that you have held on to these years?
I have a few items of his clothing that I keep in my closet still. One thing that I have, because it's all I have of him physically. I don't know if this sounds pathetic.
Not in the least. Whatever it is, it's not.
Of course not.
When I got back to my apartment for the first time after he had died, I knew there was never going... The likelihood of them recovering the bodies was very... little. So as far as I knew, I had nothing. He was gone. So I went around my apartment like a forensics unit, just trying to find like individual like hairs.
Yeah.
So I pulled like a few hairs off of his pillowcase and like one off of his towel. And I think I found like 7 or 8 hairs. Like, and he had just short blonde hair. Oh. So it's not much, but I put it in a special little envelope and, that's all I have of him physically, but I keep that very close and
sacred.
Yeah,
sacred hairs.
I have voicemails and I listen to them sometime to hear his voice. And
Those are. I don't know if you remember this story, but when you were young, you were about 8 years old, and we went over to our friend's house, Deborah, and it was a fall fest that she was having, and she had this thing set up in the backyard. It was at night. And you had to walk up the stairs, and then there's a platform, and then there was a rope, and you had to hold the rope and like jump into the unknown, and there was mattresses underneath. So I remember being very scared to do that, and I walked up the stairs, because you wanted to go up, so I was terrified, but I walked up, and I held onto the rope, and I let go, and at the top of my lungs, I screamed, "What can I hold onto so I can let go?" Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it's like. You know, there's so much letting go and loss. And for you, you tried so hard. You looked around the house to find anything you could hold on to because you had so much letting go to do. That's such a tender story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, no, but that's it. It's like it comes back to that thing about like the little things are everything, know, and the things that I wanted of his had no real material value necessarily. It wasn't like a watch. It wasn't things like that. It was like his hair or like a ratty t-shirt that just was him to me.
Of course.
That's the stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you wrote a couple of pieces that I loved and I totally devoured and read over again a couple of times and was sobbing while reading. Not just like a little like tiny tear. I was like sobbing reading them. It's very touching and you're a great writer.
Thank you.
So you wrote something called A Widow's Food Guide to Grief. It was in the Washington Post in 2018 and it detailed the stages of grief and how one might realistically feel at any given moment in relation to food. So I thought it really bravely confronted loneliness, which is, I think, in some way assumed that if you are widowed or if, you know, if somebody important to you dies, particularly being widowed, though, because it's your partner, I think it's assumed that loneliness is there hovering. But I think that, like, to really, I don't know, admit real loneliness and talk about real loneliness is something that people are really afraid of, you know? And so I really appreciated how you confronted talking about loneliness in this piece. And I was just wondering if you could kind of talk us through the piece a little bit, because it kind of talked about like your appetite and how you can feel at any given moment realistically. Talked about food people might bring you, which I think is something that's interesting. So can you talk to us about that piece a little bit?
Yeah. So I just, one thing I was just so conscious of, I think because I had been a full-time food writer at the time that he died, was how my relationship with food, something that was so joyful and nourishing to me, just became so unimportant, so meaningless, and just so blank. You know, and that's something that I just kept striking me over and over again. And I think that also coming back, Bobby, to something you had mentioned earlier, just the physicality of grief, just the loss of appetite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just how much it's like being physically ill in so many ways, which I had no idea grief was so physical, but it is. And so, yeah, one thing I just wanted, several things. One is like, yeah, the loneliness factor. It is hard to eat across from the empty chair. And one thing that I did was I started sitting in his chair.
Wow.
So that I could look across at my empty one instead of his.
Mm-hmm. What a power move.
And that's very strong. Well, now I should say that's when I wasn't eating in front of the television.
Okay.
Because that was definitely like my biggest crutch of all. But that's one small thing. I just was like, I just didn't want to look across at his empty seat.
Yeah.
So it was like a fiction, but in a way it was like played a little mental trick on me to help.
Mental tricks are important.
They really are, you know? And of course, like just touching also on like people want to bring food. And I think that is so wonderful and so important. I think early on, like a heavy cheesy casserole wasn't so much it.
Right.
It was like broth.
Right.
Chicken, rice, simple.
Right.
Stuff you want to eat when you're sick, in other words.
Well, we were talking about the year of magical thinking before, but when Joan Didion talks about that,
her friend
brought out the kanji, Yeah. We were actually just speaking to someone earlier who lost a child, and she was talking about how, for her, when people would bring food, because she was a cook, and she still is a cook, and cooking was her way of caring for her family, she was like, get these casseroles out of here. I don't want any more of this stuff. And it felt like a nuisance and a hassle and like too much. Did you feel like that at all with people bringing food to you?
I experienced that less than I think other people do, because I think people who are like more part of like a church or something like that, or like have suburban lifestyles, get more of that kind of casserole-y thing.
Right.
So for me, it wasn't as noticeable, but I also know people who have gone through that, and it just is like, I think it has been very complex though for them, because it's like, on one hand they're so grateful, on the other hand I don't really want like a taco pie.
Of course.
So, but how do you say no?
So you were living alone.
I was,
and that was part of it. So what were some things that people brought you that you remember, or things they did for you that helped you?
I remember the first meal I was really able to eat was just chicken and rice my sister made for me, which is very simple. And I remember eating it and being just like, this is delicious. And she's like, oh, it's just something silly, but it's just exactly what I wanted to eat.
Yeah.
The girls at Food 52 sent me a jar of granola. And it was so good. And that was great, too, because it was something that just like, simple, I can have a little of or a lot of, but just a little bit different at the same time. That, I remember that being really good.
And no expiration, too.
Yeah.
So there's no pressure to be like, I have to eat this, or there's no instructions.
Yeah. And like a cheese plate was good, because that's something just like you can pick at, like fruit and cheese, like little things, because I think your appetite can shrink down to the size of like a walnut.
Right.
So just things that you can pick at.
Yeah. Yeah, you were asking me that question earlier today about, like, people bringing things, and it's so complicated, because I think it's, like, one of the only ways that people know how to cope with grief. You know what I mean?
They're just desperate to do something.
Yes. They want to do something, right? And so
and cooking is love.
Right, and so most people don't feel equipped to be like, well, I'll sit down with you and really talk this through for an hour, and we can, you know, you can, like, blow your nose on my shirt. And I think that people don't want to know about, like, they don't want to clean your house, right? So there's, like, it's kind of the bar for what people do when somebody is going through a terrible time and experiencing extreme grief.
And outside of your intimate circle, because your intimate circle can...
Right. Your intimate circle can change your sheets.
Right.
But
exactly.
A person who you kind of know just wants to send something. And so, I don't know. I mean, I feel like even if you throw it in the trash or you don't eat it or you give it away or you put it in your freezer and never look at it again, I don't know. I mean, for you, was it the effort or the food, or was it sometimes both? I mean, were you ever able to just be thankful for, or was it enough just like, oh my God, this person brought something, even if it wasn't something you wanted? Or
the appreciation was always there. And yeah. And the appreciation is always there in other contexts too. Like we were talking before about sometimes when people say the wrong thing.
Right.
And just learning to be appreciative that they tried and they meant well.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing of all. But I also think like at the time, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know that I was even as conscious of all that as I should be, because I was just so messed up. Yeah. Like, a lot of stuff just happened while I was just on some kind of emotional autopilot or crying right. all the time. Totally. So I don't know, like, if I even really took in all that was happening around me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's as if a fog descends. And how much do we really see in the fog? You know, we're in the fog. We're standing there, but we don't really see much.
Yeah. And there's no context yet for us to look back on it and reflect. We're just in it.
Totally. And the fog is a protection.
So you wrote another article that I really liked. It was called The Condolences End, Being a Widow Doesn't, also for the Washington Post. That was a couple years earlier, right? 2015. And you talk about the loneliness of widowhood in like year two after some of these things like bringing food and checking in every day ends. Can you talk to us about that? Because I think it is, you know, something that I know that unfortunately like I've maybe done myself sometimes, or and I've experienced that on the other end of like, oh, wow, you know, people don't really keep up necessarily. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I think that we live in a 24-hour news cycle where there's the big story and then it's over and then something else happens. And I think that that's very analogous to kind of a grieving person, because I think when the grief is very new and upfront and raw and ugly and there's a funeral going on and all of this stuff happening, it's in everyone's face and they're aware of it and they're participating in it. But then, same thing with the end of the funeral, then that was, it's like, well, that happened already. Mm. And people, I think, resume their lives as they should, and they go back to their normal. And then, you know, I and anyone who has, I think, lost a close loved one, you're just beginning.
Right.
And so something that happened 2 weeks or a month ago or even 6 months ago is to them is still brand new to you. And right. I think because it's not on their front burner anymore, I wouldn't ever blame anyone for not understanding this, because I don't think you can understand unless right. you've been through it yourself. But I remember just kind of sometimes wondering, where is everybody? It just still felt so brand new.
Yeah.
It reminds me what my friend Kathy did when her husband died. She stood up in front of 300 people were there, and she said, please, I need every one of you to think of me and include me in your activities. She said,
so brave.
A month from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, ask me to go to a concert. Call me for dinner. Come over and visit. That's the one thing you can help me with. Right now, I'll deal with it. I'm hunkered down, but in the future, that's when I need you.
Wow, that was amazing that she had the presence of mind to anticipate that and to say something.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like that.
You know, the truth is that part of what the definition of grief is that it's accepting the reality of the loss. And in the beginning, we have that numbness and fog to protect us so we don't have to take it all in at once. But then over time, as the fog lifts and the reality descends, you know, often the second year, you have more reality. This is my life now.
Right.
So it's a very different feeling. You're no longer in the emergency. You're in your everyday life. And you're realizing that your beloved is not with you, and you're living your life without them.
Oh, I'm still doing this?
Yeah.
Like, I'm still living? He's still dead?
I was just going to say that. I had someone who lost a very significant person to them, and the way they would describe it is like, I can't believe that you're still dead. Like, this, it's so weird, and I feel that even with thinking about my dad sometimes, I'm like, are you really still dead? Like, I really want to tell you this thing. I cannot believe this is still happening. Like, It's a weird
sensation. Because, again, it's not progressive. It's not as if the reality progressively, we get it. It's not. It's back and forth, and I get it, and I forget, and I forget. And you can wake up. I'm sure you woke up in the morning, and, well, where is he? How could he not be here?
Yeah.
And you get ambushed by it in the weirdest ways and at the smallest times. It's not always on the big significant days that you think you realize the loss. It can just be kind of out of nowhere, and it just can hit. And they just keep being dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so hard.
It's fucked up.
Uh-huh.
It's terrible.
That's how it is.
It's fucked up. Yeah. There's really no other way to describe it.
Yeah.
When did you feel like you got the... When did you get back into the kitchen after this experience?
It's funny. I got back into the kitchen probably a couple months, maybe a month afterward. I moved in with my sister and her family for a time, and at some point just decided, okay, I need to try to cook one night a week. You know, I can't just be sitting here like a blob. But I remember one thing that happened was I would just mess everything up.
Really?
Oh, my God. Things that were easy for me before, I would burn. I would forget ingredients. Like, everything would just turn out wrong.
Discombobulated.
Yeah.
Is there anything you remember specifically that...
Oh, God, yeah. Let's see. I forgot to put, like, dumb things. Like, forgetting to put mayonnaise in egg salad and wondering... Wow. Like, wondering, like, why is this so pasty and dry? Forgetting to set a timer on a roast chicken. And then, like, an hour and a half later, it's, like, smoking out the kitchen.
Right.
So just this forgetfulness things. Like, I used to call it widow brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think it also goes back to just the physical symptoms of grief. And I read something about this. And, Bobby, you might be able to speak to this, about how, like, that's an actual thing that happens. Like, the blood redirects to other parts of your brain responsible for survival.
Yes.
So you're not being able to make these, like your memory isn't as good. And,
right.
You know.
Well, you know, it's a flooding of stress hormones that happens in an emergency. And the interesting thing is that the animal kingdom, after they have an emergency, they start shaking violently.
Right.
And they shake out the stress hormones.
Like a dog when it shakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
After an experience, they shake. You know, a deer in the wild and a tiger's just gone by, and they were in a freeze mode, and then all of a sudden the tiger leaves and they start shaking violently, and the stress hormones leave their body. But that doesn't happen for us. The stress hormones hang out for a really long time, for a year or more, and it changes our chemistry. And, you know, trauma is in the foreground. Whether you're not thinking about it or not, 24 hours a day that trauma is with you. So therefore, the little things that you had to cook a chicken, that's in the background. That's way back there. So it's very, it makes sense that you forget things.
I was wondering about it in the sense of that, does joy in some way keep you alert? Like, does your sense of joy, like, connect to your sense of purpose, connect to your sense of timing for things that you know how to do, like put egg salad, like, in, you know what I mean? Is there something about, like, the absence of joy being, like, just forgetful? Because what does it matter in some sense if the chicken burns? I don't care.
Right.
Is that make
there
sense?
Was definitely, yes. Okay. Yeah. So, and I think that you're making a really important point. So even though I started cooking again and granted messing up at all of it, you're right. I wasn't enjoying it. I was doing it because I felt like it was something I should do.
Right.
Not because I really wanted to do it again. And I also think too, like, meals can be very emotionally fraught. Going back to what you were talking about, because to cook a meal for one is to acknowledge that you're cooking for one now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think there's a tendency to, like, want to avoid any more triggers than you have to.
Right. And, like, so, you know, even, oh, I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, because also, you know, just talking about food, I remember, I don't know if, I think this is kind of a common thing, how, like, right when someone dies, you'll be driving around and just wondering, how are all these people going to restaurants? Don't they know that, like, my husband died?
Right.
And it's just kind of this weird thing. And I remember having been writing all these food articles about, I don't know, I'd just written something for, like, Food 52 about, like, how to keep your fresh herbs fresh longer. And I just remember that was like fun for me to write. And I was like, yeah, like people don't want to have swampy parsley after 2 days.
Yeah.
But I remember after he died being like, that's so stupid. Who cares about cilantro? Like,
right.
Only death matters now.
No, totally.
The priority shift.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And most people say they really don't want to be alive. It doesn't really, it's not that they want to kill themselves. They just, life doesn't matter the same way. So they're kind of walking around in a place where things don't matter. So we talk about a lot about living as if. And what that means is I have to live as if I care. Because if I live as if I feel, I will go so off track. You know, not only will my parsley, you know, mold, but my whole life basically will be off track. So we learn to live as if it matters to make a meal. Live as if it matters to go to a restaurant or call a friend, even though you don't want to. Does that make sense?
I wish someone had told me that. A few years ago, that makes so much sense, and that's so empowering of a statement to say. I remember I had a grief counselor who told me to indulge my grief. She's like, you fight depression, but you indulge grief. And I interpreted that as meaning that if I just wanted, if it was, you know, 70 degrees and sunny outside on a beautiful day, but I wanted to just binge watch The Sopranos in my jammies,
yeah,
then that was good for me, that I should do that because I'm indulging my grief.
Right.
But looking back on it now, I think that was wrong.
It's not wrong. It's both. It's the duality. Mm-hmm. You're doing both at the same time. You know, we talk a lot about giving space to grief, and I think that's what your grief counselor was trying to tell you. You have to give it space even though it's so uncomfortable. But the duality is at the same time. We try to stay somewhat on track, you know, above the water, because particularly with a spouse, and I'll tell you why, because there's nobody else to take care of, you know, it's just you. And that's one of the hard things, that, you know, with the death of a child or the death of a parent, you still have a family that's connecting with you. And you said that you moved in with your sister. So how did that change things when you moved in with your sister and her family?
Well, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it? Don't you find that sometimes it's easier to care for other people than it is to care for ourselves?
100%. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, I think because to actually care for yourself is, in some way, in those times, is like giving up your sad. It's like giving up little pieces of your sadness. And I think your sadness keeps you bound to the thing that you lost, I think. You know, I mean, that's just in personal.
And sometimes
experience.
We learn that in our own families. We learn self-negating for different reasons in our own families too.
Right, but in a time in a time of grief, this is just my opinion, but I feel like, okay, I get out of bed today, I take a shower, and I eat spaghetti, and I see my friends. You know, and like that is self-care. That's taking care of yourself. That's doing some positive things for yourself. And in that moment, you forget a little bit, just for a little bit, not forget, but you put it back, you know, into another compartment. And when you're really in pain and you're really grieving someone's loss, you kind of don't want to do that because you lose a little bit of it. And, you know, like the only thing you kind of have to hold on to is pain for a while. So I think that's why. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's true. I think there's something to the idea of feeling it so acutely that, yeah, there is a connection there. But it's so interesting too, because I remember I went, there's this yoga place in Lenox called Kripalu.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We both know it well. We've both been many times.
Oh
yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
So I went to this, like grief weekend thing, and David Kessler was speaking at it and he specifically addressed that. It was so interesting. And there was a woman who had lost her child, and she was talking about how she feels like, I mean, this had been maybe 8 or 10 years, and I think she had complicated grief. But she was talking about how she couldn't let go of the pain, because if she let go of the pain, she was letting go of her daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was like a bond, like the bond she had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But he was...
David lost a son.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what David Kessler said was, tell me a story, tell me a happy story. And she told this story about how they baked cookies together. And after the story ended, he asked her, how did you feel when you were telling that story? So he felt happy. Did you remember that? Could you see her in your mind's eye? Yes, yes, yes. And he said, the whole time you were telling that story, you were smiling. Mm. And I wanted to point that out to you because you don't need to cry to feel connected. Wow. You just smiled and felt connected.
That is so powerful.
Yes.
It's extremely powerful. Okay. We're going to take a really quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have some more chats with Lisa. Okay.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
And we're back. Hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you again. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Zaz. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. So I wanted to talk a little bit about another piece that you wrote. The bread I still can't bake. That was of all your work that I read that made me really emotional. That was the biggest one. And you described so beautifully how you and your husband, Eric, used to make beautiful breakfasts for one another. And, just, you mentioned so many like sweet little things. It was just very touching. And then you spoke about a bread, I believe a molasses whole wheat bread that you still can't bring yourself to make. And I really appreciated it in the article, how you were not judgmental of yourself about it. And it was like almost you were celebrating the fact that you weren't going to make it as like a positive thing and that you didn't need to make it. Can you talk to us about that a little bit? Because I thought it was such like a nice, it was a gift to give yourself in a way of not pressuring yourself and not judging yourself.
Yeah. I think that took me a while to get to that place where I was able to not judge myself. I think that it's very easy to actually think that you're failing at grief because you're not doing it well enough or fast enough, or you're still not as pulled together as you thought you would be after a year.
Or others expect you to be.
Right.
Exactly. And I think that it's really easy to put a pressure on yourself for something that's really just made up. You know, there's no right or wrong. It just,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grief is what it is. So yeah, there's this one bread that I used to make, we kind of always had it around, and it's this great, recipe, and we'd have it every morning toasted with our eggs and fruit and avocado. We like kind of just did a big old breakfast every single day. And, I still have not made that bread. And I've thought about it, and I remember thinking to myself, I was like, it really is tasty. I really like it. I should just make myself do this so that I can almost like check that box of like,
yeah,
doing it. And then I just kind of was like, why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, why do I have to put myself through that if I don't want to? It's already been hard enough. So I still haven't made it. Still delicious, but just accepting that some things might never be okay again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really important. And I think, you know, we talk about how you are people who experience extreme loss and grief are just forever changed, you know? And actually, I think people who experience small losses and grief are
the little T's
changed.
And the big T's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Little traumas,
little
big traumas.
And big traumas. But, I think it was a really significant way of just being kind to yourself and not putting a pressure on yourself, because yeah, if you don't, If you don't need to make it again and you don't want to make it again, you won't. And if you want to make it again someday, you will. And I think it speaks volumes beyond the bread. I think it speaks to like what we were talking about compassion towards yourself. If you don't want to get out of bed and get up, you don't have to. But, you know, but it's one way of being in that feeling. It's not like all encompassing where you're just like, I'm not ever going to cook again. Not to say that that would be wrong if someone could never cook again, but you know,
it reminds me of the small things you were talking about. It sounds like that molasses whole wheat bread is a small thing that was such a big thing.
Yeah.
And that it's sacred to you and Eric, and that, right? And that's what
and
it was.
And breakfast can be a very intimate meal. You're in your jammies, you're just waking up, and it's usually just a more private meal.
Yeah.
I think that's something, too. I think it's important to remember with grief is that you might be looking for the day down the road where you can get back to normal, mm-hmm. and just realizing you're never going back there. That I can promise you. But I think I can also promise from my own experience that you will be okay again in a different way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that kind of ties into kind of one of the last questions I was going to ask you. And maybe the answer is the same or maybe it's different. But we always like to ask folks if you were facing yourself at that moment, right when you lost your husband or in the couple of days after, and you could give yourself one piece of advice and tell yourself one thing, knowing what you know now about what the journey's been like, what would that be?
That's so interesting that you asked that question, because I will say I actually did do that right before I walked out of my apartment to go to Newark Airport to catch a flight to Seattle. After I found out that he was in the accident, I got out a Sharpie and I wrote on a post-it note, "It will be okay." And I stuck it on my bathroom mirror for when I got back, because I knew what was going to happen. And I knew that I would be walking back into that apartment and he would be dead. And so I left that post-it note for myself to see when I got back. And somehow I just had to believe that. And so I would leave that post-it note for myself all over again.
It'll be okay.
I still have it.
And is it?
Yep. In a different way.
Yeah.
And by okay, I don't mean fixed.
Yes.
I don't mean that I'm over him.
Yeah.
But life has a way of being lived again.
That's a very beautiful way of putting it. Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about what you are working on now? Because I think it's very interesting. It's very in line with what we're thinking about and talking about, and it's so exciting. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the projects you're working on?
Yes. So I'm very excited that in addition to just food writing for other, and writing in general for other media, I am doing my own website called Unpeeled, and it's just a general cooking and food website, interviewing cool women in food and profiles and things like that, recipes. But also one of the most significant aspects of that is the Food and Grief Project. One thing that really struck me so deeply was not only the ways in which food plays into grief, whether you're trying to bring something to someone, whether you're trying to nourish yourself, there's so much to it. Whether you have a memory of someone you loved with food,
mm-hmm.
there's so much there, but also how underexplored it still is.
Mm.
And so I really think that that deserves a little more light. And I think that's also something that is so important that you're doing as well through your own experience and your work.
Thank you. I mean, I think we always say that kind of the ethos of this show, and I think we share this, is that grief is this Oz-like kind of figure, you know, and we live in a death-denying culture, and it's interesting when we talk about how people say the wrong things, you know, when you're grieving, it's almost like, how could they not, like, nobody, there's no playbook, nobody talks about this, why is there a class talking about the most obscure kind of mathematical problems, and there's no class in school being like, hey, everybody dies, and some people die too young and tragically, and here's how you could speak to somebody, you know what I mean, you would think, right, but nobody does, and I think that, you know, our goal is to disarm some of that and open up this conversation. I know you're trying to do the same thing, and I so excited to see what you build and what you create, because I know it's going to be amazing, because you're amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. Right back at you.
Thanks.
And I think this is just like a really special thing that deserves to get talked about. And the more we talk about it, the less, I think, of a stigma it'll have attached to it, and less uncomfortable it will be, and less scary.
Yeah. Right. Because, you know, it's scary to be in grief, and it's scary to be in experiencing loss. And it's scary to, in a very different way, to be someone who is trying to be there for someone who's in grief and experiencing loss. And honestly, like, you know, and I in no way mean to call you out, Mom, but you're the most experienced person when it comes to bereavement that I know. And when my dad passed away and I felt I was experiencing a lot of depression and I was really grieving, I know that you, as someone with the most experience, you wanted.
And well, you're a mother too.
Right. So I think just the, like, you know, the more we can all, and every one of us, even you, everybody has so much to learn about that, because it is being there for a grieving person is like an act of self-discovery and figuring out how to be comfortable and brave with that. So there's just so much to talk about.
And, you know, one other point, the truth is, in a way, everybody is so unique what they bring to grief. You know, I'm a grief therapist, which is different than a grief counselor. And that means that I'm not just providing grief education, but I'm helping people see how they uniquely are viewing their grief, because we all have a different lens of perception that comes out of our history. Mm. So we all view grief differently depending on our history of losses, our personality, our supports, the many different reasons why. So I think it's helpful to understand how we individually view it. So therefore, people need different things in grief. I thought the story about David Kessler was very interesting, because we all need something different.
Totally.
And we all need to sometimes have the perspective of how we're viewing it, why we're viewing it that way, and what might help in our perception.
Yeah. Well, this was an amazing talk. And we are so honored and privileged and just so thankful that you decided to be vulnerable enough to share your story, and your writing is beautiful. And where can folks find your writing now, like on social media or on your current website or your future website? Please let us, everybody, know where to find you.
Yeah. So I have, my website is unpeeledjournal.com. And if you go to unpeeledjournal.com, you can find my bio, links to writing, as well as the Food and Grief Project in its entirety. And I also would love to have people write in and provide their own submissions on food and grief memories or a recipe that ties them to someone they've loved and lost. So I'm really excited to see where it goes. And I think it's going to be someplace really special.
Yeah, we do too. We're so excited.
And we're kindred spirits. So I hope that maybe we can connect in some other way in the future. Because we're on the same path here. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I know.
You're welcome back to the studio anytime you want to come. We'd love to have you.
I think we should all cook together sometime.
Oh, my God.
Fun.
Say no more. Let's go right now.
I'm accepting that invitation. That sounds great.
No, that would be great. That would be really awesome. Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to talk about what to make. And we'll whip up something good. Thanks for having us. And it was so amazing to meet you. And I'm excited to have a new friend.
Yes, me too. Thank you. And I'm just so honored to be here. And I just think what you're doing is just hugely important and meaningful. And I think people are going to hear things that speak to them and maybe just give them just that something that really clicks. And they're just, so that's a really powerful thing.
Thank you. As we always say on the show, to quote Viktor Frankl, survival is a community event.
Yes.
So we need each other to heal.
Well, you guys, thanks so much. It was great talking to you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
Bye. Hey guys, hope that you enjoyed our chat with Lisa. I was so touched by so many of the things that Lisa shared with us, particularly what one that stands out was the story that she told about gathering her late husband's hair and saving it. And it was just, that brought me to tears during the episode. It brought me to tears thinking about it afterwards. And Lisa is really just such an incredible person, and we're so just grateful for her openness and vulnerability. And we really hope that you all check out Unpeeled Journal and follow everything that she does, because she's a beautiful writer and she writes very candidly about
you know, as she mentioned and we talked about in the episode, but the real experiences with loss. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do here on the show. And just there's all kinds of strange things that you experience in the wake of a tragedy or really any kind of loss that you might have not anticipated. And it's good to know how the mourner and the griever is feeling as someone who's not mourning and grieving alongside with them. And then, yeah, just kind of find out where you guys find a happy medium and how to be helpful. And, you know, the reality is that sometimes you might bring something or do something that wasn't the right thing. And the person might have a reaction. But if you guys have a loving relationship, like, you'll work it out. So I feel like an effort is always a good idea. And if your effort isn't the right effort, I mean, try to think about it as much as you can first. But you can't always nail it in life on either side of on that line. So I just want to reiterate that if anybody that's not even the right way to put it. If anybody's having a hard time, we're all having a hard time. If you need anything, please reach out to us. You know, if you are in really deep despair, please contact a mental health professional. This is a time that we all need a little extra help. We obviously can't see our therapists one-on-one or see a new therapist if we need to, but a lot of people in the therapy community, Bobby included, are seeing patients via Skype and via phone, and that is a great way to stay in contact with your therapist and not isolate, because this is a time when we're all feeling a lot, and it's important to stay connected with people who have an investment in your well-being, whether that be a friend or family members or a mental health professional, therapist, a psychiatrist, you know, whatever. It can be easy to slip into some bad brain space and, you know, go down some paths in this thing. And I've found myself doing it myself, you know. And then my kind of angle here is when I feel like I'm going into some murky waters with my thoughts, I really try to just phone a friend. And if that friend doesn't pick up, I phone maybe some random person, and not even to talk out what my murky thoughts are, but just to like have some human contact. Because, you know, in our normal life pre-coronavirus, we could be having a really like funky day and then, you know, go for a walk and bump into a friend and chat with them, or, you know, go sit at a restaurant and read a book, and it changes your, you know, what's happening in your brain. And without the capacity to do that, we have a lot more time to just sit with our unpleasant feelings, which can be good and bad, right? I've found that I'm really working through some stuff that I've been not willing to confront for quite some time because I am forced to sit with my thoughts. But when I see the thoughts taking a turn to a place where I don't think that they're productive or useful to me, I try to reach out to someone. And I hope that you guys do too. And there's also plenty of hotlines available for all sorts of issues. If you don't have a therapist, if you feel like you can't call friends or family, and you can always write us a note, and we're happy to talk to you via email and share listener letters. Also, I just want to mention that in many ways, what's happening now is a class war, and that there are a lot of folks out there who have nothing before this and now have nothing minus a lot. If you are someone who's listening, who is a person of privilege, who is not deeply affected by this crisis financially, has some extra time, has some extra money, you know, use your power for good. Use your platform for good. Use your voice for good. Use your resources for good. There are so many people and so many organizations out there that need help. The restaurant industry has been decimated. That's something that's close to my heart, as I'm an industry person. And, you know, we record at Roberta's and Heritage's, a food radio network. There are obviously homeless shelters, there are blood banks, there are, I mean, the list goes on, food banks. Find something that is meaningful to you and find a way to donate if you have money, even if it's only $5. Undocumented people in this country are having an especially hard time. They cannot get government assistance. We already societally neglect undocumented folks. Prisons are overcrowded, and that has been a problem before coronavirus, and now a huge issue as our prison population stands to get ill in the, you know, as this could, you know, spread through our prisons and will spread through our prison system. So anyway, whatever the issue is for you, please find a way to help if you can help. And ask others to help. And, you know, are there people in your community? Are there immunocompromised or old folks who shouldn't be leaving the house who could, you know, use a grocery delivery? Maybe someone who just needs a phone call. Honestly, a smile. If you are going out for necessary errands like groceries and going to the pharmacy and stuff like that, or, you know, taking a solo quick walk around your neighborhood or a run, smiling at people actually really makes a difference. If that's all that you have to give at this point because you don't have extra resources or extra time, then just a good smile. It just gives somebody else a little bit more power, I think, and a little bit more hope. And, you know, as difficult and horrifying as this is right now, in a lot of ways, I have hope. And I know that can be hard to hear because maybe you're not ready for it yet, you know, and I understand that. Very similarly to when you're in grief, maybe you're not ready to think about it getting better because that's just beyond your scope at the moment. So that's okay. But I have hope. I have moments of feeling hopeless, but I think my overarching feeling is hopeful. And I look forward to someday hugging my friends and family again. And I also look forward to seeing how this changes the world for the better. And I really hope it does. And that it depends on how much we take out of this ourselves. It depends on what we really want to learn during this experience as a society and what we learn about ourselves in terms of how we want to change our own behaviors after this. You know, how we treat our earth, how we get involved in our community, how we get involved politically, how to protect people who need protection, who it's been now more clear than ever do not have it. How we want to, you know, lessen our carbon footprint. You know, I hope that we learn something. I hope that we get closer. And I'm excited and hopeful to see what that is because I believe in people, even though I feel disappointed by certain social structures and, you know, things like that. I believe in human beings being mostly good. And I really, when I have moments of feeling hopeless about that, I remember that I believe in people. And that gives me the strength that I need to get through every day right now. So we love you guys. Thank you to Lisa for joining us and being so open. That was really generous of you, and we loved chatting with you. Please check out Unpeeled Journal for some really great food content. Lisa was kind enough to interview me on Unpeeled, and my interview is up there. We talk about processing, and we love you guys, and please be good to yourselves and good to each other. Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at @processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.